The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And from Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
So I'm parked on the side of the road, right by the woods, and I'm on my way to go quit my job. And I am so nervous. And I shouldn't be.
Hi, Allie.
Hi, Jimmy.
World, this is my wife, Allie Gutierrez. And what we're playing here is a recording from a little over a year ago, when we were pretty new to the state. You were working at a retail shop, and your boss was pretty much a nightmare. But why did you want to quit?
I wanted to quit because I felt like dirt when it came to the way I was paid, the way that I was not paid. There would be situations where she would want me to clock out in the middle of the day to go run errands for the shop and buy stuff off of my own credit card for the shop, to produce for the shop, which is insane. On every occasion that she could, she would throw projects into my backpack as I was leaving.
Like she would open up your backpack and stuff...
And physically stuff papers or material into my backpack so that when I get home, I can continue to work, because there was this, like, all the time speaking about this bigger picture of how we have to sacrifice and we have to donate hours. What? I will let you know. I am going to be walking in shortly, and I'll be back to tell you what went down. Okay, wish me luck.
And so you went and did it. You went and quit that soul-sucking job.
I did. And I recorded everything after, too. Can you hear me? Okay. So I just quit. And I have a headache because somehow that quit took from 10 to 11:30. So
I remember you telling me it was actually like 2 hours that you were trying to quit and she wouldn't let you. But back to this story, how did everything go down? How were those 2 hours spent?
Oh man, so I did not intend for it to be 2 hours. I kept it kind of low key. I just kind of wanted to just quit and get out. So I didn't really get into like the nitty gritty of the situation, but she just kept pressing and not respecting the words that were coming out of my mouth, not listening. I kind of lost it. And I said, you and I do not do business the same way. It is immoral the way that you do your business. And I don't want my name associated with this at all. And she literally said to me as I was leaving, after I had like, I made her cry. And I felt bad about that, but I wasn't being heard. And she literally ended the entire thing with, okay, we'll see you tomorrow at 9 a.m. And I thought to myself, at what point do you just literally walk up and out of the room? And so I did.
Obviously, I'm biased, and I know you pretty well. But I also know this wasn't easy for you. What do you hope that other people take away from your story?
I hope that my story would inspire other people who have the same personality as I do. Like, always thinking and giving people the benefit of the doubt. Always thinking that they've got your back. Giving everything you have, heart and soul, into something. Thinking that they'll recognize that and they'll respect that. And I'm learning that that's a rare thing to have that. And that's not something you should let go of, that you should hide. But you need, like, that's a gift. And you need to be able to protect that gift until you are in a safe environment. And it's not used, it's not abused. It's able to grow, and people appreciate it, and they appreciate you, and they understand the gold that they have.
This is Word of Mouth.
Your questions answered, your state explored.
I'm Justine Paradise, here with producer Jimmy Gutierrez.
Hey, Justine.
Hey, so I knew Allie had some work issues when you two first got to the state, but wow.
Yeah, it was a rough intro to New Hampshire.
And that is how we're starting off today's show. We are looking at work.
If you have a full-time job, most are working and spending more time with work colleagues than our families. So how did we get here? What changes could be in store for the work week? And why does it feel so liberating to quit a terrible job? Justine, do you have a good quit story?
I've got a couple. There's one that I started working also at a retail shop, and I was younger. I was 18. And I just realized very quickly that it was going to be super soul-killing. I think that Allie said that. And luckily, I lived in a community where there were lots of jobs, so I wasn't going to be in desperate need if I quit this one. So I just kind of stopped going. This is not a proud moment here, but I just stopped showing up.
So you're an impulse kind of quitter.
You're saying that there are styles of quitting?
There are styles, yeah. So like folks that quit like very proper, like I'm giving my notice, you know, 2+ weeks and sitting down with the manager, letting them know what's up.
Right, like a lot of communication.
Lots
very
of communication.
Professional, yeah.
Well, there's the ghost millennial quit.
All right.
And then there are bridge burning quits.
Ooh. Let's hear about some of those.
Last night, RT made international headlines when one of our anchors went on the
record.
So
this is RT, formerly Russia Today, and this is their anchor, Liz Wall, and she is going off script.
Is she quitting on air?
Oh, yeah.
And that is why, personally, I cannot be part of a network funded by the Russian government that whitewashes the actions of Putin.
Dope.
Yeah. So that seems timely. Anyways, this next one could be my favorite. This is the story of Stephen Slater, and he was a flight attendant for JetBlue.
He was a man at the end of his rope, a fed-up flight attendant's bizarre behavior.
I remember this guy. Like, didn't he quit on the intercom, like cursing out the passengers or something like that?
Yes, but that's not even the best part. So he curses them out. He gets into it with the passenger. He ends up grabbing a beer, popping the emergency exit and sliding down the evac slide to the tarmac.
Down to the tarmac. Port Authority police say Slater took off, hopped on the airport's AirTrain shuttle back to the parking lot, and drove home. That's where he was arrested.
Working class hero. Oh my God, that's like a rock star quit.
That is a rock star quit. So that's the bridge burn rock star. We'll give Slater that one. For our finale, a true bridge-burning gem.
Now, everything you heard is why I, the actual owner of the Alaska Cannabis Club, will be dedicating...
So this is Charlo Green, and this video has over 100 million YouTube views.
...for freedom and fairness, which begins with legalizing...
So this is another news anchor here.
Yeah, yeah. She is from Anchorage, Alaska. As you can tell, she is very pro-weed.
And as for this job, well, not that I have a choice, but... F*** it. I quit.
All right, we apologize for that.
Oh my God, on live TV, that is no joke.
I know. Here, check out her what her colleague says after. She's just dumbfounded.
We'll be right back. Pardon for us.
Whoa.
Meanwhile, the guests on 2
hard to recover from that moment.
Right.
So I don't know if it's because we live in like the viral age and these stories are really mainstream, but it feels like past generations, older generations, look at millennials and Gen Zers as not being as committed to their work. The presumption there being that we have weaker or worse work ethics.
Yeah, I hear that. I think a lot of it comes down to how work and businesses have kind of shifted their practices over time. Have you heard of the Fair Labor Standards Act?
Yeah, I've heard of it, but I don't think I could tell you about it.
Okay, so to understand how work and this idea of working has evolved, I think the FLSA is a good starting point. This legislation is 80 years old, and it was a part of the New Deal package. So it established things like a federal minimum wage, a maximum work week pre-overtime, and prohibited oppressive child labor.
Right, like fundamental sort of ways to shape respect to the workplace and being
right.
treated well.
Right, right.
So we've had these protections in for a while. New Deal, that would have been 80 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Although it doesn't seem like the minimum wage has moved in a while. So do you know how those standards are applied today? Like 80 years is a long time.
Since it was signed in, there's been a bunch of amendments to it. But the idea of work has changed so much for our generation. I think it's probably fair to revisit this. It's estimated that anywhere from 40 to 30% of the current workforce is part of the gig economy, meaning that they're self-employed either part or full-time, which makes obtaining benefits and any sense of that old-school work security really elusive.
Right, there's sort of an apocryphal story, like, of, you know, graduating college in the 50s and 60s and just making some calls and, like, getting an interview and getting a job. And to us, I mean, I've applied to, like, many dozens of jobs, and it's just not the same world.
To think of that job being able to provide you enough income to buy a car, start a family, own a home. But if you really want to rage out, which is something I suggest, I've got something else for you. As far as industrialized countries go, U.S. workers work longer hours, take less vacation, and retire later than our peer countries. And there's actually been no increase in leisure time since the Great Depression.
Right, so that idea of like 8 hours of rest, 8 hours of work, and 8 hours of play is just, a fantasy.
Right, or you just do it till you're 70 or fall over.
Yeah, I don't think I really plan to retire ever, really, right?
I think that's fair. I could die here.
Sorry, I know that you wouldn't bring all of that up without a solution, and I think that maybe I have a sense of what you might be proposing.
Yeah, I don't stop talking about this, do I? This is the 32-hour work week.
A lot of people will have heard of the concept of a shorter work week in terms of you making the decision yourself to get paid for less time in order to have a bit more time on your hands. So, for example, a 32-hour work week might mean that you work 4 days, you get paid for 4 days, and you get the fifth day off.
So who are we talking to?
This is Charlotte Graham McLay, and as you can hear, she is from New Zealand. She's also a New York Times correspondent, and she wrote about this firm called Perpetual Guardians, who's trying out a trial run of the 32-hour work week.
But where this experiment was a little bit different is it's a 32-hour work week where you get paid for 40. So you're essentially getting 1 day's paid leave every week of the year.
So, I mean, as a worker, that's got me very excited. But why would any business ever do this?
Yeah, that's a great question. When I spoke to the CEO of Perpetual Guardian, the company that did this, basically he had read that most workers have very few productive hours in their workday. So as some studies have put it, as low in the Western world as 2.5 to 3 hours for your average office worker.
Two and a half or 3 hours that people are actually productive through an 8-hour shift?
Actually doing their work, yeah.
Wow.
Which sounds kind of appalling, but sometimes when you go back and think about jobs that you've had, so for example, obviously time spent on Facebook or even not even technological distractions, but just general distractions in the office. You know, every time someone has a morning tea or a leaving lunch or you get in a chat around the water cooler or whatever, that doesn't really count as productive time. So he read that, and he also read that distractions in the office, there's a study saying that that could be as much of an impediment as smoking marijuana at work in terms of what it does to your brain and how hard it can be to get back into your workflow afterwards. So what he realized from that was that he actually wasn't gaining that much by having people sit there for 40 hours a week if they weren't actually being productive over that whole time. So he decided to run this as an experiment and went into it with a really open mind, thinking, well, if this doesn't work at the end of 2 months, we go back to the way things were before. But what he also did was he asked two human resources professors to study the staff before and after the experiment. But what they also did was spoke to their supervisors as well. So it wasn't just a matter of staff saying, oh yeah, working 32 hours a week and getting paid for 40 is working out fantastic for me. They also spoke to their supervisors and said, how was your staff's productivity? Did they get less done? And what they found was that not only did staff not get any less done in 32 hours a week as opposed to 40, but what they also did was the staff took matters into their own hands and actually felt incentivized and motivated to try and hack their productivity and to say, well, my company's doing me a really good turn here, so what can I do to make sure that these 32 hours that I'm required to be here are done at maximum productivity?
Were there more surprising findings. I feel like the takeaway makes sense to me. I feel like I would also be motivated as a worker to maximize that time. But were there other takeaways that maybe were more unexpected?
A couple of things, yes. One of them, which I had not thought of before, was talking about the infrastructure of the workplace in the city when there are 20% fewer people coming to work every day. And I say 20% because this was how they structured it. They say in a team of five people, one person would always have Monday off, one person would have Tuesday off, one would have Wednesday off, and so on. So every day you had 80% of the firm's staff coming into the office. So what they found was that they had much less, much lower electricity bills from that period of time in which they did the experiment. So less people there using less power. But what the CEO also mentioned was, what if you were going to do this across a whole city, or a bunch of large firms in a city were going to do it? Well, you'd have 20% fewer cars on the motorway every day, or you'd have 20% fewer people using public transport. And of course, that's a way in the distance consequence, the thought of an entire city or it becoming a real cultural change where people regularly only came to work 4 days a week. So that's slightly pie in the sky thinking, but it is worth thinking about when we think about the ways that our cities aren't really working for us at the moment, and what we could do to change them. And another kind of longer term consequence of thinking about this that I found really interesting was what the CEO, Andrew Barnes, mentioned to me as the possible consequence of creating contracts for staff that are based around tasks to be performed rather than hours you want them to spend in the office. And for me, this is kind of mind-blowing thinking, because I don't know about you, but every contract I've ever had specifies, you know, you will be in the office for 40 hours a week over these days, right, and you're allowed to take half an hour paid for lunch or whatever it is. So what he suggested was that an employer and an employee should come to an agreement around what work needed to be done over the course of the week. Rather than saying 40 hours, you say, these are the tasks that I need you to perform. And if you can do those in less than 40 hours, then why should you get penalized by having to reduce your hours and saying, well, I'll take one unpaid day off a week because I seem to be able to get my work done pretty quickly. Instead, he said, well, if you can be efficient and you can be streamlined and productive, then why shouldn't you be able to take the rest of the time off paid in the week?
Oh my goodness. He's my favorite CEO of all time already.
Yeah.
But I would imagine that this could work in some workplaces, but it could be difficult for maybe what may be referred to as like essential workers, where their job is a big requirement is just them being in that space. I'm thinking of nurses or firefighters. This doesn't necessarily apply to everyone. This is maybe just a first experiment.
Interestingly, the founder of this company is convinced that this could be something for everyone. Of course, what it would require in a lot of the industries that you mentioned is much more resourcing. So if you need X number of staff on the floor or on the ground any given day, and you've got 20% of staff off work every day, then of course you're going to have to hire a much higher total number of people, 20% more people essentially, to make sure there's the same number of people there every day. But it is interesting. We were talking about nurses because at the moment, New Zealand's nurses are going through some industrial strike action for the first time in 30 years over wages and particularly working conditions, which they see as really unsafe. They find themselves working massive amounts of overtime, running from patient to patient, having to constantly make prioritizing decisions where they actually can't provide all of the care in the time available that they're required to provide. So they actually have to pick and choose what care they're going to provide for their patients, which they don't like having to do because, you know, if someone dies on their watch or gets worse on their watch and they prioritize their care and did this but not that, then that's something they could potentially be responsible for. So what Andrew Barnes from Perpetual Guardian was saying, well, what if nursing was resourced to a level where nurses could work 4 days a week, right? And of course, those 4 days could be spread over any days and could include weekends and that sort of thing. But when we have 30,000 nurses in New Zealand currently saying we are being asked to work in a way that is unsafe for both us and patients, obviously something's really broken in that working system. And what would it look like to have nurses in a position where they actually felt comfortable that they were caring for people properly and that they were able to give patients the time that they needed, that they weren't calling into work sick because they felt so stressed out or they were so underslept from the previous shift, which is something that happens regularly at the moment. So I think while obviously the 4 days a week is a very specific model, what is behind it is a philosophy and a mindset approach to work that says you should not feel sick and stressed and exhausted every day of your life, and you certainly shouldn't feel like that every day of your work life, and you shouldn't have to spend your days off every week kind of frantically trying to recover from your days at work.
I wonder how that would work on a journalist or producer kind of position. Like, I guess the fear would be that someone's going to outproduce you.
Yeah.
You know, when you're taking your time off not writing or not talking to a source, someone else is writing and talking to that source.
Yeah. I think, again, with newsrooms, and this is something I've thought about a lot because I've worked in some extremely short staff newsrooms in my time, where it was kind of, you worked for nice people and it was a real family environment. You loved working there. But at the same time, there wasn't the option of taking the day off when you were sick because they just needed a bottom on a seat from 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. and there wasn't anyone else to do it if you couldn't come in. So again, that would require, same as nursing, it would require them to overstaff the newsroom so that there were enough people there to take that 20% hit every day, which I don't know any newsroom in New Zealand that could afford to do that.
Right.
But I mean, the other thing is that I worked for a few years on a really grueling current events show, and it's grueling in that we loved working there, but it was 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And you know what it's like, 3 hours a day of live radio is absolutely absurd, especially when it's current events. So I was the youngest and most junior there by about 15 years at the time. Mm. Everyone else was much more experienced than me and was on a higher salary than me. And so I was the only person who worked 5 day weeks in their job. Everyone else worked either 3 or 4 days based on how much of a pay hit they could afford to take. And I loved that job and I learned so much from it, but I actually got quite burned out in that job and I was exhausted all of the time, but I just couldn't afford to take the pay hit of that extra 1 or 2 days a week because I was earning much less than them. And so I guess that's one of the things that I really liked about this idea was that it doesn't make it a matter of privilege whether or not you can afford to have that better work-life balance of working less. But I completely agree with you that it would need to be a cultural change, because otherwise if you just have one person who's still in there 60 hours a week undercutting you.
Right, right.
Which in journalism is always a risk, right?
Exactly. This is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored.
The second annual Transgender Rally and Picnic took place July 28th in Manchester. And it was an even sweeter celebration as the state just passed a bill granting a wide net of protections to transgender folks.
I had a chance to talk with Chloe Lacasse, who helped organize the event. She's a trans woman who works with Rights and Democracy New Hampshire. Before she transitioned, her work life, though, looked a whole lot different. I asked her about her work history before she started working as a full-time advocate, and this was when she was still presenting masculine.
Let's see. So being the ripe old age of 46 at this point, my heyday was back in the early 90s. I graduated in 1990, blue-collar family. So no college education, just went right into the workforce. I regret that now looking back. I think I missed out on a lot, you know, of worldliness, I guess, for lack of a better word. So I got into construction in 1992, just before the election. It was my first election I voted in November of 92. That started basically an on and off 25-year career in construction, and specifically HVAC. being raised a boy, you know, I didn't know anything else. And so just went about my business. I learned the trades. I learned sort of all the social cues that one will pick up in the construction trades. For those who have worked in the trades, they know exactly what I'm talking about. I know it's a little foreign for other folks to kind of wrap their minds around that.
Well, what's an example of that? You know, like, because I've worked in hyper-masculine spaces and as a firefighter, and, you know, the gallows humor is a very real thing. But there are other things, too. And I'm curious, like, what you heard that that signaled that.
Sure. I mean, it's misogyny is a way of life in certain areas. Bigotry is a way of life. It's part of the nomenclature. It's not something that is really talked about, but it's talked about. And it comes and goes, and it's all ego. With men in general, and I think certainly in these atmospheres where it is predominantly men, that it's all ego. When you communicate, you're communicating via ego. I always use the analogy of the bigger fish. You know, guy's in a circle talking about his weekend. And he's like, I went out, you know, blah, 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 and got this, you know, 25-pounder. And, you know, people are like, oh, wow, that's great. And there'll always be somebody else in that circle will talk about a story where they caught one that was bigger. It's always one-upmanship. And that's what masculinity, I think, at its core really is. And I think it suits that environment simply because, you know, it's a dirty, rough and tumble environment to build a building, for example. So, you know, it's not for the weak of heart, I guess.
Yeah. And at what point, or maybe it was the entire time and you couldn't put words to it, but I'm curious, at what point did that hyper-masculine, misogynistic workplace like start to be triggering or something that you were more aware of and wanted to remove yourself from?
Probably within 3 or 4 years, I really started to dislike it. You know, the geometry or the, you know, the mathematics, I really enjoyed that, the thinking process of, you know, going, here's a problem, I need to solve it. Beyond that, I really didn't relate with a lot of, you know, the dialogue that was going on. And, you know, I wasn't at that point in my 20s, you know, anywhere near understanding, you know, the person that laid within. But there were definitely signs, or popcorn, as I call them, over the course of my life that really sort of, you know, started to pile up. And when I really finally came to a point where those conversations, when they came up, really started to affect me, or, you know, offend me, I guess, was in the last probably 3 years. And I guess to take that a step forward, I mean, I didn't start to understand truly the person that laid within, you know, being trans. I mean, it was out there, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, and I was kind of aware of it. And I just, you know, didn't relate that to myself, even though I had been doing many a thing in my private life, you know, when I had access to that closet door and nobody was around, you know, there were things that came out of that closet, obviously dressing and things like that, which were guilt-ridden activities, but at the same time fulfilled a part of me that I didn't quite understand at the time.
I think about what was that balance from hearing all that messaging at work 8+ hours a day with your, you know, that's your social circle. And then going home and like you said, you have this popcorn that's kind of telling you and kind of like hinting at who you are.
Great question. I would say that you compartmentalize. I think in any aspect, when you're working in an environment, living in an environment or with folks that aren't speaking your truth, I think you develop a protective barrier and you sort of just block it out. You're there to do a certain thing. You do it. You put your head down. You do your work, and you go home.
You talked about the popcorns, and I love that analogy.
I love popcorn.
but what were some of those popcorns along the way that kind of like revealed, to, as you said, like this person that was inside?
July 29th of 2016 is when I went out to a drag show for the first time, and a friend of mine had posted it on the Facebooks. So he put that out there, and I had reached a point in my life after several really, you know, provocative relationships with 3 different women who kind of pulled some things out of me outside of realizing I was trans. I mean, I still, at that point in time, had still really no clue. I had this part of me which was really feminine, and I was experimenting, but that was as far as it went until that night. So I committed myself to going out. So I own that evening. I put an outfit together with some clothes that one of those exes had given me, because she was really into the concept, but not really the reality. So I wore that and went out and owned the night. And I think I had never thought of the LGBTQ community prior to that. I knew it existed. I didn't poo-poo it. I wasn't one of them. You know, I just wasn't. I never gave a second thought about my sexuality, my gender, anything, even though there were these pieces of popcorn that were piling up. At this point, you know, 44 years old, I probably had a massive, you know, bag of it in my, you know, in the closet. That being said, it was like when I went out that evening and I owned it, like, I looked good. So at that point, I was basically embraced by the LGBT community, and we ended up at a drag bar in Manchester, New Hampshire, and it was phenomenal. People didn't run away, they didn't laugh. It was just the opposite, and I think that acceptance to be seen, and I think that was for me. It was like that was the first major step, because I never did it anywhere but in my private time alone, because I was so afraid, because masculinity doesn't allow for any sort of femininity. In that, I was allowed to be me, something that I really, really wanted for so long. And when I did it, people were there and they were like, you look amazing, girl.
So you're still working. And
correct.
So were you able to talk with coworkers? Were you able to share any of this? You're shaking your head.
Absolutely not. That is just no.
And what would have happened if you would have?
I know what would have happened.
Because non-discrimination bills, 1319,
well,
didn't pass.
It didn't exist.
Federal law wouldn't have protected
you.
Boys
are a tough bunch. If you boil everything down to ego and arrogance and jokes and, you know, and that rhetoric that goes along with it, that's all it is, right? That's how men communicate, and certainly in those environments. And I knew, as a matter of fact, because I've been witness over the course of my days in construction, what happens when there's somebody that walks into that, you know, to that job site who looks a little off, whether they be feminine or goofy or nerdy or any number of things. And, you know, whether it's to the person's face or not is another story, but they'll eat them up. And a prime example of this, and why, you know, I was reminded very early on that I would never tell anybody, because A, I didn't have these relationships where I needed to tell anybody outside of work. But I had this pair of sunglasses, which were, you know, I don't know, Jessica Simpson's or what, I don't know what they were, but they were, you know, they were quote unquote woman's sunglasses. And I had picked these up, and it was kind of one of my little things that I did. And I like them, you know, the lenses were great, and I liked the way I look in them. So they're in my glove box, and I'm on lunch one day with my coworker. And I love this story. So I have this headache, you know, you got any aspirin? I'm like, oh yeah, go, you know, it's in the glove box, go get some. He gets the aspirin out of the glove box and he sees the glasses. And he pulls them out and very calmly turns to me and goes, you got girls' sunglasses in your car. I'm like, yeah, they're mine. And he pauses for a second and you could see it on his face. And he's like, these are girls' sunglasses. And it was just like this disconnect of like, how can this be? You're super masculine. You know, you're this person I know. Why would you wear these? I'm like, because to use a phrase, badass, I'm not sure I can say that on the radio.
Oh, yeah.
But and I put them on and like, you know, kind of carried the day. And that became a running joke amongst all, because that word spread. And because we both laughed at it and you just own it. And it's like, yeah, no, I wear these glasses. And those comments would constantly come in from different guys. You got your girl's sunglasses? You got your girl, you know, so... Just if you think about a pair of sunglasses as a trigger, can you imagine the level of which it would go if you said, hey, XYZ?
I mean, I can't. Thinking of people that are in that situation and then have to go into work every day and kind of face up to that, it just seems impossible, really. Thinking of your work trajectory, though, over that time, from getting into the trades to advocating now, I just feel like it takes a lot of endurance. It takes a lot of that voice could have gotten beat out of you, it feels like. But the fact is that it's who you always have been. And so I guess I'm just really curious on how it feels to go from a place where you weren't affirmed, you had to hide who you were, and just to the point where you get to be yourself, you get to be your true self every single day. You get to talk about it openly. You get to encourage other people to do the same. It just feels like a huge win.
It's a win. No, no, it's definitely a win. I accidentally fell into this, I think, I truly believe. It was 2014 when I met a person who, quite by accident, opened the doors in my bunker. And that short relationship challenged me as well as just opened me. I mean, to have somebody walk into your life and say, you're beautiful, you're important. And it was being, I mean, she was saying this to me in as somebody exhibiting masculine. That led to another relationship that quite literally destroyed me. But looking back now, it's what I needed. And then the third one was kind of that awakening, that rockabye baby, if you will. And it was a wonderful bookend to the first person where, you know, they were reciting the same things that first person said. There was this moment where we were sitting together and she was like, you're so amazing. You're so talented. You're going to do such great things. And in tears, I was like, no, I'm not. No, I'm not. To shortly thereafter find that event, you know, the drag show, and then subsequently, you know, the whirlwind that's happened since, I didn't know what happiness was. I was a flatliner. Things got really, really bad in my life or around me, for me, whatever. Didn't affect me. I was very calm. Things got really happy and excited and people were doing this and that and experiencing life. I didn't get it. It was like, I can see what happiness is supposed to look like, but I can't comprehend it because I never felt it. It's obviously because I wasn't living who I was. But at the time, it was just, you know, this is who I am. This is what my life is. This is what being a man is. And that was it. I just kind of reserved myself to the fact that I was going to both remain alone and unhappy. And if I could earn a living and do my thing and just get through it, and that's such a sad thought to look back on, I'd be okay. No one was going to hurt me. So for these three relationships to really challenge me on a human level and find me in a position where I was like, you know what? Screw this. I'm going to that show and make that leap of faith and take what was personal and private and embarrassing and show it to everybody. It's been a revelation of epic proportion. And it's changed my life. And hopefully, moving forward, I can, you know, bring change to others.
That was Chloe Lacasse, Media Production Coordinator for Rights and Democracy New Hampshire.
Chloe was also the MC for the second annual Transgender Rally and Picnic, where people were celebrating holding space together, as well as the passage of the state's Transgender Non-Discrimination Bill.
In the spirit of togetherness and community, whether you're LGBTQIA, identified, an ally of, a friend of,
a wide cross-section of transgender people from all over the state are here to celebrate our win, but also to celebrate each other.
Places like this are just really awesome because I can dress however I want. I can paint my nails and put glitter on, and it doesn't matter. It's kind of a no-holds-barred situation because you can just express yourself, and that's like the best part.
I was employed in the computer industry for 31 years, and when I came out and let them know I was going to be transitioning on the job a couple months later, I lost my job. It was buried in a layoff, but I knew what it was because they hired somebody in the same time that I left. That was devastating.
June 26 makes me a cancer, an emotional ball of mush with a heart as fragile as your average cis male's masculinity.
I've been writing poetry for about 2 years, but I've only been performing for about a year, year and a half. But it's been a really good way of me like getting my feelings out, especially with the struggles of what it comes when you are transgender, the dysphoria and the discrimination you face can really be debilitating for a lot of people, which is why bills like this were so important to pass. I just got approached by someone who's doing a high school project on LGBT activism in New Hampshire, and they wanted to interview me so that they could write about my experiences that I shared in my poetry.
I did this project because my best friend was transgender, but we are no longer talking. But I decided just to, yeah, high school. It sucks. All of my friends were assuming that this was me coming out and just, well, how could you hide this from us? And I was like, but I'm not. I'm just doing this because everybody in Groveton needs to know, because we are such a hard community and we I got bullied when I first moved there because I was a different color than everybody else.
I'm a PFLAG mom. I help facilitate a support group for parents of trans kids with my friend who's here at the Freedom Massachusetts table. It's something I actually had very little clue about prior to my son coming out. Like most parents, I worry about my kid. He's 23 years old and just starting to make a life on his own. And I've got that extra layer of worry because he's trans. And he's a guy who still likes to wear makeup and nail polish. And you worry about how people are going to treat him out in public.
This is Transposition Vocal Ensemble, which is New Hampshire's chorus for transgender singers and allies. And there are a couple of different reasons that I started this about 3 years ago. One is that I feel that trans voices should be heard. And another is that I feel that they should be heard in a positive context that has nothing to do with bathrooms. And so music is a very gendered thing for a lot of people. And so taking that out of it and trying to open it up and saying your voice is your voice and nobody should be able to tell your voice that it's not good enough, that it doesn't fit into the right box. Nobody should be able to silence you, either your thoughts or your song.
This is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored.
Sometimes work can empower. And if you're a girl, woodworking or working with power tools and building something from the ground up isn't always encouraged. Executive producer Erica Janik went to Manchester to learn more about Girls at Work, the nonprofit that's teaching girls how to build the future they want.
I'm Kaylee.
I'm Bella.
I've been here for about 4 to 3 years.
Me too.
Bella and Kaylee are two of the leaders of Girls at Work. It's a program for girls based in Manchester that teaches them how to build everything from shelves to picnic tables using power tools.
Well, we build our own separate things. We build podiums for like the mayor and schools. And we also build a few smaller projects too.
Picnic tables, stuff for weddings, cupcake holders, dog bed things, lap desks.
Bella and Kaylee, my guides for the day, are 12. I asked them how they became leaders.
We've been here for so long, and then we started to show that, like, we could step it up, and we were, like, able to do things on our own without being asked to.
And we boosted up our leadership.
Leadership is right. Bella, Kaylee, and some of the other girls have been on television, spoken about their work before crowds of hundreds, and attended the inauguration of the mayor. The two gave me a tour of the workshop. It's located in the bottom floor of an old school. There's two workshops filled with tools and benches. In one, the walls are covered in writing.
And also, as you can see on the walls, they have, like, lots of, like, inspirational quotes from people that have been here. So everybody left a mark. I like this one over here. It says, FEAR, which stands for Face, Everything, and Rise.
Girls at Work wasn't Bella's first choice.
I wanted to sign up for cooking, but it was all booked. The next thing was this place. So I went here and I really enjoyed it.
Much to her surprise.
Quite shocked that I preferred this over cooking class. And also, Girls at Work, we help the girls. We teach girls to teach themselves that they're really powerful. Girls are really powerful. They just sometimes don't know it yet. So it's kind of like locked up inside them. But Girls at Work is the key to opening a little cage of power for them.
Unlocking that cage of power is exactly what Elaine Hamill had in mind when she started Girls at Work.
The message they get over and over here is that the power's not in the tool. That screw gun will spin all day long, but until you exert some pressure and power on that thing, it's not happening. So, you know, they leave here, they can't help but know they're powerful.
27 years ago, Elaine, then in her 20s, was working as a general contractor in Manchester.
Many, many years ago, I took a neighbor in whose parents were drug addicts, and they weren't too concerned about being parents. So she ended up with me full-time when she was 10, and I signed her up for summer camp, but I was a struggling contractor at the time, so I couldn't afford summer camp. So I asked if there was anything they needed built, and the camp director said, yeah, come and teach the girls how to build. So I went to camp for a week when I was 27, and it was incredible that they were They would show up before breakfast to clean the shop. They would beg to work through lunch and dinner. And I mean, when you put power tools in little girls' hands, it's a game changer.
The camps are geared toward at-risk girls. Elaine has a broad view of what that means, particularly in light of what these girls are seeing on TV and in the movies.
I mean, women's roles are victims, they're abused, they're raped, they're murdered, like you name it. And so we have little girls here who tell us their babysitter is the television. So if you think about the constant messages they're hammered with, the bullying is out of control in the schools because it's trickled down. And we have a little girl here today whose 11-year-old classmate committed suicide.
Putting power tools in the hands of girls as young as 6 wasn't an easy sell, as you might imagine.
You know, it took a very long time for people to get the message. You know, because when I first mentioned I wanted to do this, the feedback I got was just brutal. I mean, you know, little girls and power tools, you just don't do that.
But safety is a top priority at camp, and they haven't had any accidents. When I told Kaylee and Bella that the jigsaw, Kaylee's favorite tool, scared me.
You gotta be scared because you're safe when you know you're scared.
But it's good that you're scared because it teaches you to be safe. There has never been one accident, like someone getting hurt by a tool here.
Safety wasn't the only obstacle, though. Elaine says when she was shopping her workshops around to camps in New England, she heard that her classes weren't necessary because they already had woodworking at boys' camps. Power tools give girls literal power, but Girls at Work is about teaching critical thinking skills.
The power they tap into in this space, and we're not doing it. They're figuring it out. It's the larger focus is critical thinking. So they get bundles of lumber, and they get a model that's finished. And they have to dig really deep, and everything gets screwed together. So they pre-drill everything and screw it together. And when you're 9 or 10 years old, you better put your whole body on that screw gun.
Elaine has put power tools in the hands of more than 15,000 girls. But who put one in hers?
Nobody. I could not get anyone to teach me because I was a girl. And ironically, I grew up with 5 brothers who don't use power tools. Dad is a chiropractor. No one. I was a struggling student. I actually spent 2 years in this school as a little girl, but I have no memories because I was an abused kid. And the men that did the damage are no longer with us, but I mean, what irony, right? I'm back here with the same age girls I was when I was here. So no one put a tool in my hands. I mean, I acted out a lot as a kid, and so I get these kids. I mean, I know what they're about. I know where they're at.
In recent years, there's been story after story about the looming crisis in skilled trades due to the average age of the workers. Elaine is teaching these skills, but it's never been her goal to get girls in construction. But that's partly because her own experiences working in construction were so rough.
It's never been a goal to get girls in construction. From experience, it's a brutal environment. But I've had to let go of that mindset, because the average electricians and plumbers are in their 50s. And we had a welder come from Boston last week, young woman, and she brought a bunch of stuff and she talked to the girls. And I can't even tell, I got bits and pieces of it, but I talked to the girls after she left and I said, "What'd that do for you?" And this kid puts her hand up and she says, "I'm gonna be her when I grow up." And the rest of them, the feedback that came out of these kids, I was just blown away. But yeah, it's time to figure out a way around that mindset of not sure they should get into construction. So hearing that from the girls firsthand, that, you know, seeing that welder and hearing her talk to them about how tough it is out there, I need to trust they can handle it. And we just got to make sure they're prepared for that.
What have you learned about yourself?
We're powerful.
We learned that we're powerful and we can handle being pushed. So when we're getting pushed, we can deal with it.
As I was leaving Girls at Work, Kaylee called back to me, "You should come build with us."